Good afternoon and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. We are in the thick of the season for farmers markets in Anchorage and around South Central Alaska. My own recent visit to a midweek market made me want to talk to some farmers, and that's what we'll be doing today. So I'm curious, how are Alaska farms doing? What is the nature of the soil on our farms? Are we saving our farmland or losing it to development? Given Alaska's distance from lower 48 farms and the pipeline of food coming to us from down south, how are we fixed for food security? And how do Alaska farms play into that? And I have more questions. What is life like for a farmer in 2018? What are the challenges? And I'm talking budgets and finance, keeping a workforce, dealing with the changing climate, or ongoing trends in American food habits. So I have lots of questions and a great panel on the show today to give us this landscape. Here in the studio with me, I have Margaret Adsit, Alaska Farm Tours, and formerly with the Alaska Farmland Trust, and the daughter of a grain farmer from the Midwest, right?
And that is correct.
So Margaret was my first contact, because once I was at the markets, I was like, I want to learn more about farms. How do I do this? And I stumbled on Alaska Farm Tour, and there was Margaret's face, and she looked friendly. And I thought, oh, she's the daughter of an Alaska farmer. So I thought, I'll get her on. Well, it turned out, no, she's not, but she knows every other farmer in Alaska. So she became a conduit to me, for me, to some farmers. And we have in the studio with us also Christy Short from Bush's Bunches.
Hello, how are you?
And she is Alaska born.
Yes, I am.
It's not that we think Alaska born people are better. It's just that we identify them when they are. So Christy, thank you.
Born and raised.
You would be in the trenches today if you weren't here in the studio. So thank you for...
Yes, thanks for getting me out of the field.
Yes, it's always good to get a break, right? And we also, in the studio, we have Rachel Miller, who's with APU and really focused on food security here in South Central, I guess, or all of Alaska. So, Rachel, are you a professor?
I am. I am an assistant professor of business at Alaska Pacific University, primarily working in marketing, entrepreneurship, and more recently, food systems. So food systems research, often through the lens of entrepreneurship.
Okay. And I know I was tracking down Liz Snyder at UAA. I didn't quite connect with her, but I understand you and she work together on a lot of food security issues.
Correct. Closely. UAA and APU are currently working on an agreement to launch FRESH, the Food Research Enterprise and Sustainability Hub. So with a goal to aggregate academic research in the circumpolar north and make it applicable to real world projects and problems and sort of be that go-between or that conduit for a lot of academic work that may not always be accessible to the public for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. You might have some academic windows into what we would want to study about Alaska farms.
I would hope so.
Okay.
Yes.
So, but we also have other people that are going to be guests on the show, we think, depending on how their day is going in the Valley. We hope to hear from Sarah Bean from Arctic Organics. Now, that's a name many Alaskans know because Arctic Organics has been with us for a long time. But we thought it would be great to hear from a seasoned farmer just a little bit about life as a farmer and what she's thinking about and doing. And one more guest, probably about 2:45, we expect to hear from Johanna Heron. She's with the Alaska Division of Agriculture and in particular a program called, at least one program, she's probably involved with many, but $5 Alaska Grown Challenge, which I think is challenging Alaskans to try to spend $5 a week on Alaska grown produce. I hadn't known about it, so hopefully she'll tell us about that and what else she's working on. So now, always on Hometown Alaska, we welcome folks to call in and ask questions or share their perspective. And so if you want to do that, in Anchorage, the number is 550-8433. And statewide, it's 1-888-353-5752. And also, we do take email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And we do tend to get emails as well. Last thing I want to tell you is I put some good links on alaskapublic.org under Hometown Alaska. And so we are going to talk about the Alaska Food Policy Council. We're going to talk about things that you might want to delve into a little bit more. So I have put some of those links on our website. So please feel free to do that. It's easier than remembering all these separate ones. So we try to do that as a service to people. Okay, so I'm going to start with Margaret because she was my first person. And Margaret, I admitted to you right away, well, I know there's farms in other places besides South Central, and we're probably not going to get to the Delta area and some of these other places, but just in a couple sentences, just tell us, where are the farms in Alaska? I know there's one, for example, in Bethel.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, yeah, Tim Myers is yes. out in Bethel. When you're looking at agricultural areas in the state of Alaska, you sort of look at four, maybe five distinct regions. You've got the Fairbanks region going down south a little bit, Delta Junction, not to disregard those folks out in North Pole who are doing some really cool farm work out there. And then going down a little bit further south, Kenny Lake. And then coming down into the Mat-Su, we really start to see farms around the Farm Loop area just south of Sutton going all the way down to Homer. So we're in the South Central, including Kenai, a very productive agricultural region. There's some farms down in the southeast. You see a lot more greenhouses as well down there. So that's sort of a very brief overview of sort of big agricultural areas. There's some farming in the western half of the Mat-Su Valley up until Kenai and Trapper Creek area as well.
Mm-hmm. Now let's hone in really on Mat-Su and talk. Can we talk about how many farms? You know, no.
Oh, you want to know like
well, just
specific
kind of,
farm numbers?
Well, I know, I'm not going to hold you to any of these numbers. It's just to give people a general idea. Are we going up or down? Now, okay, Rachel has an answer.
Academic raised her hand. I would ask to that, what are we considering farms? Are we considering this backyard chickens who are exchanging with their neighbors? Mm-hmm. Are we talking about agricultural people who are self-identifying as farmers? Or at what scale? Because I think that that's something that's really diversifying throughout the state is people have this back-to-the-land attachment. And we mm-hmm. see it more and more in urban areas, too. So, Margaret, I'd love to know what you think about that.
So at the start of our farm tours, we actually define what is the Alaska food system.
And, oh, that's good.
And so within the Alaska food system, you know, a food system is everywhere from, are you buying from a restaurant? Are you buying from the grocery store? Are you buying from a farmer's market? How are you acquiring food to get it to your table? So that whole pathway for that is part of our food system. And in that, sort of how we grow food for ourselves concept, you can't disregard sort of the impact of gardeners and how much they're bringing in food to the state. There's also this sort of, as you were saying, smaller farms who are self-identifying as a homestead or a subsistence grower for themselves on farm. And then beyond that, you have folks who are actually doing production farming where they are selling food for a cash value or sometimes a barter value to consumers. And so my tours mostly just focus on that last group, but Alaska as a whole, in terms of our food system, there's these other growers which are contributing to our food security in the state.
So the vision we have of the farmers of the 40s and 50s, it's shifting. I mean, probably as a response to our own concern for where does our food come from, maybe first, and then, wait a minute, we're in Alaska. What if the port falls down? You know, where's our food going to come from? What if something dramatic happens, another earthquake? So that there's just been a general shift of curiosity and interest in local food, which might manifest itself not only in farms surviving, but also people farming in their backyard, in a sense. So you think that's true?
That's trending?
Yes, I mean, I can speak for myself. I'm a poor grower, but I do try. And the only thing I'm really successful with is kale. I have tons of kale. So then it's like, kale recipes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, chips. Right.
And also,
I'm really good with dill. For some reason, dill loves my backyard. So I have beautiful, beautiful dill. But you can't really live off of all those things. So, you know, I'm thinking I have to amend my soil. So, you know, I have to start, you know. So, okay, so what we've got this overview. I want to bring Christy in a little bit because we actually have an actual farmer here in the studio with us. She's a farm manager at Bushes and Bunches, grew up in the valley, thought she was going to be a forester, learned before the show, but found her way. And why is that? Why are you at Bushes and Bunches?
Well, yes, you're right. I did try to be a forester. I went out in the field, out in the woods with my grandpa. He was a forester, and taking DBH and heights of different trees.
What's
and
DBH? Thought, what is DBH?
How round it is.
Oh, diameter or something?
Round.
Like that? Okay.
Think of round.
Okay.
And, you know, grabbing our sack lunches and going around to do that. But went to Colorado State University, Natural Resources Management. And at first I'd gone for forestry, but decided to broaden that. And then one thing led to another. I came back up here and pretty much started working for Alaska Oceans Network through Alaska Conservation Foundation. That's still natural resource related.
Kind of natural resource management.
Yeah.
Education.
Yeah. And then some years passed, and I ended up working with the Mat-Su Farm Bureau, doing the Alaska Grown program through them, and then working for State of Alaska Division of Agriculture
in the Alaska program.
So, yeah, and then I started talking to all the farms. I knew that at that point, gosh, this was 2013. I know there's more farms in the state registered through the Alaska Grown program now, but at that point, I think it was 767-ish.
So 767 farms.
That people had actually said that, yes, I'm a farm.
So that might not cover your backyard chicken.
Yeah, it wouldn't, because some folks just don't want to be known. And yeah, a lot of those folks would sign up and be in the source book, the Alaska Grown source book. So if you're in an area and you're in a region, then you need to know, well, where can I find peas?
Or chicken eggs.
Yeah,
or,
you look that up on the source book.
Now, let's do talk just briefly. I want to get to how you got to Bush's Bunches, but tell people about the Alaska source book. And I saw it online. I saw the 2017, I think.
Yeah, it's every other year.
Okay.
They update it every other year. And it's supposed to be a nice go-to so that you can find where's kohlrabi in your area.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a list of all the farmers markets, which have been exploding. Mm-hmm. So that's really nice.
Yeah, I just stumbled on the one over at the Airport Heights on a Wednesday afternoon. Kind of went over to pick a loaf of bread up. And my goodness, I could also get ice cream and some fish.
Right?
And fresh basil. some other things. I lettuce for dinner. So, they are really... And that is just probably still more this response to wanting local food, fresher food.
Well, and I know when Amy Pettit was working with Division of Ag, she was really big into bringing in the Chef at the Market program. So we got that going, which really helped with a lot of the markets. And people were really into that. Mm-hmm. And you get a chef there showing you how to use these things. So you're not just having kale chips. You're not just having kale smoothies. Well, what else can I do with my kale?
Yeah.
So
it
was really, really responsive to that, that the crowd went wild.
So people can find that just by going to the Division of Ag, which is under the Department of Natural Resources.
Yes.
And it pops right up. I know I found it very easily.
Yes, it's very, very under the Alaska Grown program.
And you can sort of search by what you're looking for?
You can do it that way. You can search by region. You can search by product.
Mm-hmm.
So you can find just about anything.
Okay. But now I want to know what a day is like at Bush's Bunches for you. You are actually the manager now, right?
Yes. I'm slowly transitioning into from managing. I started off as store manager for the Bush's Bunches
stand. Which would be the storefront?
The farm stand. Which is, I think, the only year-round farm stand right now. Even though year-round is different, even for us, we have to close down for a few months because we just run out of product.
Mm-hmm. Carrots finally...
Yeah.
You run out.
Okay. Yeah. Pam can't supply everybody all the time.
Yeah.
But I started off with that last fall. Went into a health scare with Bruce Bush. Mm-hmm. Bruce Bush in the fall was reminded of his immortality.
Mm-hmm.
That he is not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so he really started thinking about, well, how do I want this farm to succeed in the future? How is it going to work? I don't have anyone, my kids don't want to do this. My sister just wants to deal with the greenhouse. So
I need somebody.
And so he, you know, over a beer, I think it was at Palmer Bar, we just started talking about this and said, okay, well,
I need
you want
somebody.
It. You want food still grown there or do you want it to become houses?
Food. Yeah.
Let's do food. Let's feed the community. Let's keep it healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way to keep the community healthy is giving it proper
nutrition. So you were like an understudy there?
I'm an understudy.
An understudy. And then now you're actually doing the job.
Yeah. And this year I am. I'm in the position now and I'm learning the serious learning curve of everything he does. I have to consult with him every day. Okay. What do you do with this? How do you do this?
Yeah.
What's the best way you've learned in your 50 years to do this?
Right.
So,
and one of the things Rachel pointed out, who's from APU,
mm-hmm.
let's talk about women farmers, and we're talking to one right here. So I'm just kind of, are you an anomaly, or are you a growing common fixture, female farmers in
the
Valley?
I hope there's more of us.
We're going to talk with Sarah Bean, who's been a farmer for a long time.
And it's funny that everyone on the panel is woman and
female. We're all female.
We all had a discussion in the beginning, and it was kind of like, well, what do you call a female farmer? And Christy said,
I'm the boss.
You call me your boss.
What do you call a female farmer? The boss.
Okay. It is to interject, this is Margaret again. It is the fastest growing sector in agriculture, sort of in terms of leaps and bounds. You see more young women and women who are in their second career transitioning into farming. So it's the fastest growing ownership is transferring to female ownership.
Do you think it's the motherly aspect of us?
Maternal?
Our maternal instincts kicking in and
I honestly think it's a way to have balance in both facets of your life, you know, that you can keep kids around and or I think
control your schedule to a certain extent.
I think for a farm that's that diverse, there's some more skills that are required. Yeah. You know, multitasking management, people management. Not to get deep into the psychology of female versus male management on
spaghetti
a farm.
Spaghetti brain.
Yeah, no.
Versus so single lower box.
I don't know if anybody's actually defined why that is, but I'm very glad it is because it was very disproportionate earlier on, and that's sort of in transition. And so, yeehaw to that.
Yeah, I spoke on the phone with a young woman who was a food writer and said she read something by Michael Pollan, and I had the story wrong. I thought it made her stop wanting to write about food and work on a farm, but the truth is she wants to work in farm policy. She couldn't join us on the show today, but I was really fascinated by that. I listened to Ag Matters. Margaret told me about Ag Matters, and it's a half-hour radio show that you can find easily on the web, covers a lot of Valley farmers and farm issues, mm-hmm. and one of the things I heard was a guy from Fire Island Bakery that came up in 2010, helped start that bakery, but went outside and farmed with his wife, came back, and now they have an urban farm in Airport Heights, I think.
Is that Jason?
Jason, yes. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the shows that Amy Pettit featured. She had you on also, Margaret. And another one that she had was about saving Spring Hill Creek. Spring Creek Farm, mm-hmm. which is associated with APU, right?
It is. The branding can get a little confusing, but the short of it is we have Alaska Pacific University, we have our Anchorage campus, and we have our Palmer campus. And Louise Kellogg, decades and decades ago, entrusted APU to be caretakers of this land through the Louise Kellogg, actually I believe it's the DeWolf Kellogg Trust. And she was an incredible mover and shaker who came up here, and nobody would sell her farmland. And so she ended up, when times crashed, she was able to, through family wealth, acquire more and more farmland in the Valley. And she was able to create this sort of this little oasis of farmland that we continue to preserve out. And sometimes it's referred to as the APU Farm. Spring Creek is our brand for our CSA. And so we lease some of the land out for haying. We run our CSA off the land. And so Spring Creek Farm has been through its ups and downs like every other farm. Mm. And we continue to grow our vegetables out there. But that's our Palmer campus.
This is Christy. If you haven't been out to Spring Creek, go.
Can you go? How do you go?
You talk to me. But really, you can reach out to Margaret. Everyone knows Spring Creek Farm. And we're really always happy to have folks come and chat with us about opportunities for the land. We're really excited. APU, we have a new partnership with Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. And so thinking about ways to use the land for better understanding subsistence foods, mm-hmm. and subsistence harvest and traditional foods, mm. And ways of using the land out there for that as well.
Mm. So how much property is out there? Well, you don't have to know the exact number. But you have land that you're tilling, but then there's enough land that you might maybe start to learn how to harvest natural foods.
We do. I should know the number of the acreage.
This is not meant to pin you down.
It's a little around 900 acres.
I was going to say 8. Okay, great. Okay, yeah. On target. Thank you, Margaret.
So a little around 800 mm-hmm. acres. Okay. You know, we have to take a little break here. Mm-hmm. It's time that we do three segments and... And so we're going to take just a short break, and then we'll come back and we'll start talking more about farms, and I'll introduce our guests again. So you're listening to Hometown Alaska. This is Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. We're talking about farms and farmers today on Hometown Alaska, just because I went to a farmer's market and I just got so interested and wanted to learn more. How are our farms doing? You know, so we've got a panel in the studio, Margaret Atsit from Alaska Farm Bureau and formerly with Alaska Farmland Trust. We have Christy Short, a farmer, and she's managing Bush's Bunches, new this year, big challenge. And Rachel Miller, who's with APU, she's a professor over there. And we snagged her in here because she's been working a lot on food security issues and food policy. So we want to talk about those things as well. And in a few minutes, we expect to hear from Sarah Bean, Arctic Organics. She'll probably be on a cell phone.
Oh, actually, Johanna's calling at 2:30.
Is it Johanna?
Sarah, yeah, okay. Yeah. Sarah's at 2:45.
2:45. Yep. So Johanna might even be in an office. Who knows, right? She might. Who knows? But she'll talk to us, and later we'll have Sarah Bean. So, one more time, our phone numbers, 550-8433 in Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752 statewide, and we can take your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. Okay, so we were going to talk about female farmers. We did that. Farmer education, let's talk about that, because I think everybody's been a little bit involved in that. It's called Farm to Class, or...?
Well, I'm gonna steer a little bit back to just close on what we were talking about before, which is the APU Spring Creek Farm.
Oh,
which,
yeah, right.
The Great Land Trust actually put the conservation easement on the property with the assistance of the Alaska Farmland Trust. And Alaska Farmland Trust uses a mechanism called a conservation easement to permanently restrict what can be done on that farm. So let's say you have a 40-acre parcel and you don't want to see it lost to houses, kind of like what Bruce is facing. Let's say you're a family in transition. The matriarch or patriarch is transitioning off the farm. And if the kids don't want it, what do? You liquidate your assets. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, you see that massive, rapid loss of farmland, because for a family to liquidate those assets to equally give out children their inheritance, that's like a really strong cultural thing to do. But what happens is that we see this loss of really prime agricultural lands here across the United States and also in Alaska. So Alaska Farmland Trust has been working both with Great Land Trust and doing our own conservation easements. We've got a little over 300 acres now protected, or permanently protected. And we do that as sort of that sort of lasting protection of our agricultural system. The very root of every farm is an environment in which to grow things. So you can do hydroponics, which is indoor in urban landscapes, or you need land. That is a universal truth we cannot deny. You need land for food. And so the work that Farmland Trust is doing is really excellent to keep that land in protection and to help those farms looking for another solution if they want to retire or if they are unfortunately have someone in the family pass away, that you can then have an option for that farmland. There's a motto I go by. It's land, the land, the always the land. And I think farmers deeply believe in that, especially if you've worked that land your entire life to see what can happen to it. And The other big thing on the reverse side, tying in that farmer education, when we're looking at what are hurdles for young farmers or beginning farmers, which beginning farmer doesn't have to be someone who's young. It can be someone in a second career transition, are looking for is land, and we don't have enough of it, or it's too expensive for them to sort of start a farm business. And so this is another way that we are helping them transition and have access to that land. And but in order to sort of build up faith or build up these businesses to be strong, if they're not taking over a previous business, we've got to have some farmer training or farmer education in place in the state, or a farmer-to-farmer education or internship or externship program that develops these farmers, that trains them to be able to be successful farmers. I think there is this general assumption you just stick a seed in the ground, and that is not true.
No.
To own a business, you have to be savvy in marketing, in business, in hydroponic systems, in irrigation systems.
You got to know electrical work. You got to know plumbing.
Horticulture.
That's 99% of it.
Yeah.
Plumbing,
yeah.
The irrigation.
Everything rolls downhill.
Yeah.
So how do you do that? How do you prepare someone for that? There's not really a traditional educational system that can set up. And it used to be that there were, across the country, ag schools, and there are still some remaining, where you could get, at least in part, vocational education, the skills-based learning. And so that's where the Farmland Trust is moving next. We've got our easement program going. Now we're sort of working with APU and UAA to sort of say, how are we ensuring that we are training to the best of our ability that next generation of farmer, so that we at the Farmland Trust don't have to sweat it every time we see this aging population and sort of say, we have thousands of acres. How do we have the resources to protect that?
Mm-hmm.
But the easiest way is to sort of say, let's get another farmer on that will have that land for another 40 years
mm-hmm.
and keep that land in production so we can feed Alaska.
Is the land owned by the Farmland Trust?
No. That's
okay.
A major thing. We do.
Okay.
We're not interested in being landowners. We're easement holders, which means that just like you'd have any other deed restriction on a property, ours is an agricultural conservation easement, which sort of restricts development on the property. So we usually design a building envelope so you can build further farm structures or a home site on the property. But then the remainder of that has to stay as agricultural lands or open lands for agricultural production.
And you have 300 acres, you said.
Mm-hmm.
How's that going? Are those productive farms?
So the majority of the farms that we currently have protected are hay farms, which we get a little flack about. But here's the thing. What does hay feed? Well, it feeds horses. Hay is for horses. But it's also feeding the livestock industry. So the idea being that actually having a hay is a cover crop. It's protecting the soil. So when mm-hmm. that farm... So we can't force people to farm what they want to, like, you can't just sort of say, now you must grow carrots. You know, I think that's really kind of wrong to do. We have to sort of say, you have to farm what is most economically feasible for your farm
mm-hmm.
and what makes the most sense in your farm business plan. And so
mm-hmm.
that is a real focus. Some future projects, we do have some in vegetable production farms that we're working with, but the vast majority have been hay farms we protected, but with beautiful soil, like 4 to 8 feet of topsoil.
That's what I was going to ask you. What shape is our soil in?
I would love to have 4 to 8 feet of topsoil.
Well, in broad terms, I we always have thought of the valley as very fertile, but probably every soil has a profile and it needs
yes.
to be cared for in a certain way. So talk to me about our soils out in the valley.
Well, the first thing that we did this spring, as soon as the ground thawed out enough to do it, is take a soil sample. Easy enough. Soil and Water Conservation District, send it over there. Jeff Schmink gave us a soil sample data back. We figured out what we needed to put in there to grow things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You do that
you
every
do that.
Year? That's a sort of like
we do
a like
now,
a, like a
now that I'm the manager.
Oh, okay.
Bruce was like, "Oh, let's add 300 pounds of this, that, and the other."
Oh.
Okay. How's that working out for you?
You decided to go the scientific route, huh?
I decided to go with the let's put in less on the farm. Let's be more economical and more responsible of what we're putting into the
mm-hmm.
soil.
I see.
That's
I see.
What I was going for.
Yeah.
And then if you ask our field manager, CJ, he was also raised on a pig farm down in Missouri. So he's familiar, but he's not vegetable familiar. If you ask him about the state of the fields right now, he got a really good workout pulling out rocks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so rocky soil, which is good, but that adds a lot of nutrients, right?
Yeah, but then at the bottom of one of our fields, we've got about 3 feet, 3-4 feet of really good soil, and at the top we got about 4 inches. So how do we bring that back up top? So it's fun.
And how what's the property you're working with? Bushes and Bunches? Bushes
Farm. Go ahead.
Okay, Bushes Farm. Tell me about its size and what you're producing there.
So it's actually a 40-acre lot. However, only about 14 of that is what we are working with. His sister Nancy's also got a greenhouse and area available to her to use as well. And then we also are leasing out a 4-acre plot in Inner Springer out in Palmer as well.
Leasing it. Okay.
We lease the land, and we are growing potatoes and zucchinis, different types of zucchinis, some of the delicata squash that Fire Island Bakery is going to have.
I love delicata squash.
So when you brought up Jason, I was like, oh, hey, I know him.
Yeah.
And then the pickling cucumbers that everybody loves. So that's just what's over there. It's just mostly our winter squash. And so, yeah.
I have a question about whether changes in the climate are already affecting what you're deciding.
Holy biscuits.
Okay, talk to me about that a little bit. The eyes opened wide.
Yes, that was a really, really big discussion this spring when we were ordering seeds. Sure, throw a potato in the ground, it's still going to grow. Our rhubarb, we've got an acre of rhubarb that we harvest every year and do different things with. But everything else, is it going to be a good squash year? Last year wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is it going to be a good beet year? Last year wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
So Farmer's Almanac, oh, yeah, who's heard of that?
So when we're talking about sort of research, get back to sort of what Rachel is doing and what Liz Snyder is doing at UAA. That's like a big area that we have like the no knowledge of. I mean, here's the context of Alaska farming. Like, we don't have the research facilities that a lot of universities across the country do in terms of supplying farmers with that knowledge and information of like creating what's your plan of attack, what's your plan of action. Most farmers are doing their own test plots with their own varieties to sort of see, going back to the soils, certain giant variations in soil types across the valley. Like you're in Western or at Point McKenzie versus in the Springer system versus even in Lazy Mountain or the Butte system, completely different soil profiles of what kind of amendments you need. And there's not a guidebook really currently in the state that if I send a young farmer to sort of say, okay, you had your soil tested. This is your typical profile. This is what will grow readily in here. Here are variety lists that you can do. We don't have that. So I'm going to like punt it over to Rachel and be like, hey, how can we do that? Like, how can we revive that?
Before we do that, I just want to say Johanna's on the phone.
Oh,
hi, Johanna.
She made it?
Yes, she's on the phone. So
I will hold that card. I have so many I'll hold.
Yes, we're going to come back to that. So I'd like to welcome Johanna Heron on Hometown Alaska. Hi, Johanna.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, we're really super happy to have you. And we were just talking about farmer education, and how does the Division of Agriculture fit into that?
Yeah, so at the Division, we have a vision that every Alaskan deserves access to healthy, clean, and high-quality Alaska-grown food and farm products. Every farmer deserves that reliable and consistent market, and every business, organization, and individual will eventually know what their role in that process is. And so there's a number of programs that we run at the Division, but the two that I'm really excited to share with you about today are the Alaska-grown $5 Challenge and the Restaurant Recognition Program. Do you just want me to go into explaining a little bit about those?
Well, this is sort of how the consumer can get engaged, right? So tell me about the $5 challenge, and then tell me about the restaurants, because I didn't know about that one either. So go ahead.
Oh, yeah, they're both great ways for the consumer to get involved. So the $5 challenge is geared towards if every Alaskan spent $5 a week on Alaska-grown food and farm products, we would see $188 million circulating through the economy. So it's a really exciting way to engage with Alaska-grown foods. And what we've done is basically we're encouraging and challenging every consumer to find Alaska-grown products wherever they can. So on the farm, at farmers markets, and in retail, or even at restaurants. And and to spend that, make that commitment to spend the $5 a week on it. We did an actual separate kind of partnership with the retailers in the past 2 years, where we're really encouraging them to build displays and put out promotional materials to make it a lot easier for you to find in grocery stores. So Fred Meyer, Safeway, Walmart, a lot of these stores have all of those marketing materials and have these goals to make it a little bit more easy to locate in their retail sector.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you've been doing it a couple of years. Are you seeing a growing interest, or what do you think?
Yeah, you know, it's been a hard thing to quantify, but we did touch base with both retailers and producers. On the retail side, we heard that when they're building these displays, they do move the product pretty quickly with, selling out of it in a much faster amount of time. From the producer side of it, we've heard a few producers, I think one producer said he was going to increase his square footage up to 20% this year to meet demand because it was moving his product so fast. I really do think we're seeing that increase. In fact, one of our success stories is with Alaska Flower Company, who was able to make it into the all of the Safeways in the state for the first time ever, which was 40% of his gross sales for the year last year. So just the first order. So
we're talking flowers. Was that flowers? No, I'm sorry.
No, Alaska Flower Company. He has a variety of things: barley, flour, and then some blends and
flour
mixes,
as
like
in
cake, mix.
Cake flour, not in flowers.
Barley flour.
Barley
right.
flour. Got it. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. All right.
We did see a peony grower get into Fred Meyer this year too, though. That was exciting as well.
Yay, so, Carol Kinley!
Right now.
Rock on. And then tell me about if I'm in a restaurant. Will I see it on the menu? Are they sort of maximizing that potential to buy Alaska that way? Or do I have to wait for the person to come to my table and say, and from Alaska we have, no. How does it work?
Every restaurant's a little different, but we do. So we launched a restaurant recognition program where restaurants that were selling Alaska Grown Produce could sign up with us. And so we have them all beautifully laid out in a directory on an app called, if you go down and download Alaska Grown, all one word, you'll be able to find every restaurant that's enrolled in the program.
And I did not know that. That's great.
Yeah. Some of them have it on the menu like that. Some are very articulate about it with their wait staff. Mm-hmm. But, you know, really what we tell people to do is just look, ask, and buy. You go in and you ask if they have it. And then at minimum, if they don't have it, then you're bringing awareness to it that you prefer that.
Huh. So it's, tell me about that app again, and I'll try to get a link on our website, too, just to make it more available to folks. How do you find it again?
You just go to your app store, and it's on both types of phones, and it's all one word, Alaska Grown.
Okay.
And you should be able to download it. The other place that we're pointing people is to the buyalaskagrown.com website. So you can go to buyalaskagrown.com, and a lot of the programs we run are on there for everybody to
Awesome. That's great. That's great. So, Joanna, anything else? I know you're busy. We caught you in the middle of your workday, but what would you like to leave listeners with if there was one thing? I bet it's eat Alaskan, eat Alaska-grown food.
But, absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank a farmer. If you know a farmer, thank a farmer. They are, you know, they are what make our world go round, and we're really proud to serve that industry.
You know, I have one question about, there's still an experimental farm up in the valley. Is that related to the Division of Ag? It's related to UAF? No?
The Matsu Experiment Station is
yes.
UAF or the university. And then we also have the Plant Material Center, which is the Division of Ag. And that's out on the Butte side.
And this is a question really for Margaret. Are they contributing research or insight that's useful to farmers? Or
The PMC has been doing some really great work in providing seed potato research. And I believe they also have a seed bank. I'm looking at you guys. Is there a seed bank? Right, Johanna?
Yeah.
Yes, you guys are
Johanna
doing
says yes.
Yeah,
okay.
The seed bank. I'm sorry, I don't work for the Division of Agriculture.
Yeah.
So there's that. The experiment farm at UAF is in transition, and also, I think on a bigger level, They gutted the extension service. So a lot of the old programs that used to exist that supported master gardeners and Alaskan farmers looking for data and research has been completely gutted. So that's not what it once was. I would say historically, it was a very important entity. And by no fault of theirs, just a lot of funding issues as we're in the great funding shakeup of the 20-teens, they've sort of had the rug pulled out under them. So that's I mean, could they do a lot more? Oh, sure. But you need a little money for that.
They need more money. Well, it is something that could be turned around, perhaps.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
if we could figure out funding sources. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. Like, that's traditionally they're funded through a state entity, and that passed through you know, UAF or UAA or however you manage that. But again, we're in a budget cut cycle. Like, we're high and dry. So for the moment, farms are doing their research on farm. They're figuring out what varieties they need to do. They're doing their own sort of trial by fire and making it work for them. But yeah, for the future of farming in Alaska, providing that level of research and getting that disseminating, communicating with the public, that research is very important when you're looking at food security. Knowing how to grow and what to grow is kind of one of those, like, foundational things we should be really putting out there for folks.
Yeah.
So,
one more question. The farm bureaus, like the Matsu Farm Bureau, they're having a tour August 2nd. I signed up just because I want to know more.
Yeah.
What does the Farm Bureau, it's not research oriented, or what kind of support do they provide?
Those are 501c4s. So they typically, across the nation, are a farm advocacy organization. They are meant to lobby on farm issues and the like. For good, for bad, for everything that they do, which, you know, around the country, they do a very different policies.
Depending on where you are.
Where you are, yeah. So you might be... have a farm bureau in a lower 48 state, not to be mentioned, where they're pushing giant industrial agriculture, right? Or you can have a farm bureau here where they're really trying to support small local farms as to the best in their membership, to the best of their ability.
Gotcha.
So I'm not going to say universally farm bureaus are, you know, working for the small farmer, but here in Alaska, I can say without
this
a doubt
one,
that they're...
These farms.
Yeah.
Okay. We have to take another tiny break.
I'm sorry.
No. You're listening to Hometown Alaska. We're talking about farms and farmers. We're going to come back and talk more about food security and probably hear from Sarah Bean, I think, from Arctic Organics. So you're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Just to run around the room with our guests, we've got Margaret Atsit, formerly with Alaska Farmland Trust, was just telling us a whole lot about it, where she used to work and how they have easements and try to protect farmland. Christy Short, who is with Bush's Bunches, and Rachel Miller with APU, and working a lot in food security, which we're going to touch on in this third section. And we want to say thank you to Johanna Heron, who's gone back to work now up in the valley. We got her on the phone just briefly to tell us about some of the ways consumers can, if they want to do something, they can go to farmers markets, of course, but they can also shop in their grocery store or look for those foods in restaurants. And I did not know about all of that. So let's transition over to you, Rachel, and talk a little bit about the Food Security Council, the concern that if we had something major happen to us, our food, I think, is in Oregon somewhere, and we take several days to
get on a boat somewhere. It's not here.
Not here. And so that's kind of alerted people. A couple years ago, I think 2011 or something like that, there was a great interest, and tell us where we're at with that now.
Sure. So just a quick background. I believe it was 2011 or 12 where the Institute of Social and Economic Research at UAA came out with a report around food security, touching on food systems indicators. So ways to measure the health and well-being of our food system so we can at least have a baseline and figure out, you know, what is and what could be. Then in 2014, Ken Meter and his associates came up with a, I'm forgetting the name of the report, but it was basically a food systems analysis of Alaska, where they touched on several different points around the state, everywhere from production through the whole supply chain to consumption, and made several recommendations for what we could do as a state to be more food secure. And fast forward to now 2018, we're using terms like food sovereignty and food systems ownership, right? So food security is do you know where your next meal is coming from on a household level? Does the state know where the food is coming from for the rest of the year? Do we have the production that will meet consumption? The answer in Alaska is no. But I would say that in a lot of other states, the answer is no as well. They just happen to be on the road system with a lot of other states. We are effectively an island economy. So we have that going for us. I think that several years ago, I think it goes back to the 70s, the statistic came up that says 95% of our food is imported. And
Alaska.
Alaska, correct. Yes, our as Alaska. And I wish that we would stop saying that until we can substantiate it.
Because it may be more than that.
It may be less than that.
Oh, maybe less than that.
The answer is we don't know. Okay. A lot of things that we need to better take into consideration are consumption patterns off the road system, what people, we have really good subsistence harvest numbers on what people gather and harvest. However, I don't think that's really been incorporated into this food security and food sovereignty discussion that we have up here. So again, food sovereignty is this right of communities to decide how they grow their food, how they store it, and how they consume it. So it's your right to your own culture.
Wow. It's very interesting. I mean, it's sort of, I just think about going to the grocery store and cooking dinner. but I mean,
it's that too.
Yeah, it is that too. And yet, how do you take somebody like me and let them understand how big it is and how and what decisions I could make beyond just shopping? You know, probably we're going to, you know, regulations, legislation, priorities, things like that. For example, the Co-op Extension Service, is that something we want back in South Central, that sort of thing?
Overwhelmingly, yes.
Yes.
So much
bring
yes.
Bring it on. I am just going to take a breather here. We're going to welcome Sarah onto Hometown Alaska. Hi, Sarah. This is Kathleen McCoy. Welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Hi, thank you. Nice to be here.
I so appreciate you taking a moment out of what is probably a very busy day just to talk with us a little bit. We've been talking about, you know, the health of South Central farms. We've been talking about succession, who will take over the next farms as we have an aging farming population, or will the land be able to be preserved? So I guess I would just say to you, what would you like people to think about? I know you've been involved with Arctic Organics your whole life. I don't know whether you have a succession plan or whether you are working on one or don't need it yet, but what are your thoughts on preserving ag land in the valley so that people are eating local?
Yeah, that's a big one. We're sort of a unique farm in that we actually didn't buy ag. We don't have ag land, so we have made residential real estate into a farm. And so I'm not sure, you know, the fact that it is a farm, it's still residential real estate, and it's still on in a residential neighborhood. So that's interesting because it's not a super.
It's not the typical story. I did not know that. Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah, we had to pay, you know, what was top dollar back 30 years ago, and now we're faced with the land around us, which has been basically forest being sold, subdivided, and you know, developed, and it'll be right up against our border, so it'll change the feel of the farm in the very near future, because here we are right in a, you know, residential street in the valley. So, but beyond that, I mean, we can't imagine our farm not being a farm after we're done with it, you know, and how where we're going to pass it, you know, who's going to take it over is, it would be our children, but whether they would actually farm it themselves or what they'll do with it is, kind of up in the air.
Now, would Farmland Trust would not be involved at all with an easement or anything, because this is not really farmland?
Margaret and I have talked about that, and we're trying to come up with creative ways to work on. If our place were a farm easement, if they put an easement on it, that would take the value of it away from our children. There's that, you know. So we're not making enough money to pass on to them besides the land that we're farming on. You know, that's about it. So our legacy is our land.
Well, that's right there, right? That's hard. How long have you been on that land?
We've been here 30 years.
That's what I thought. Decades.
Probably, actually.
And in your tenure, have you seen interest in Alaska-grown food change, grow?
I would say so, yeah. I mean, it definitely helped having the local foods movement catch on. I mean, that I feel came migrated north from the lower 48 states. I mean, that is something that's caught on in the last 10 years. And before that, it was us. You know, we were out there promoting local foods without there being much of a movement to catch the wave of, you know. But so I would say once the wave hit Alaska, we have definitely felt a difference.
You've benefited. Yeah. One more question, and my guests may have questions too, because we have farmers here in the studio and Margaret here. But I'm interested in whether you've seen or had to make changes based on different climate things that you've experienced, that maybe things that have grown well in the past don't grow so well, but maybe opportunities have opened for other things. What's your sense of that?
An interesting thought. We did. There have been definitely cycles over the course of the last, you know, 3 decades that we've been farming, where there were 10 years in there where it was so darn predictable and nice. I mean, we got to a point where we were growing, you know, things outdoors that we could never have thought of the first decade we were farming. You know, and so the way, and then that, you know, lush, very benign period ended, and it ended suddenly, and it was just sort of like, okay, well, let's get out of those bad habits and get back to what really works here and just sort of stick with what we know will work. And then in a given year, you know, we may have, you know, really nice warm weather, which makes you kick yourself for not growing the things that do well in warmer climates.
Christy's like shaking her head. Christy Shorts here in the studio with us. She's shaking her head in total agreement with you. Yeah.
There is no point to taking that risk, because we're already risking so much anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So the best thing, I mean, what we've decided to do just over the course of experience is just grow what works. Just grow what you know is going to work. And we're also following trends and, you know, styles and produce and what people are going to be looking for. We try to follow that.
Mm-hmm.
So our changes will be made more based on, well, what's going to be trendy and what can we of that list actually grow here, instead of trying to grow crazy things like, you know, well, I wouldn't even try to grow cantaloupe, but that's not exactly a stylish vegetable.
but is it
watermelon radish?
Yeah. But Chrissy, like what you were talking about, delicata squash, is that sort of a new sort of trendy thing? That
we've never done it.
You've never done it.
But we do squash pretty well, so.
Yeah, it might work.
Let's try it.
Yeah.
That'll be interesting to see.
I know. I'm excited.
It's actually a pretty good place to try it. I don't think I would try it over here.
Ah.
Our side. We're actually right near Bunch's Field, I think.
Out on Innerspringer?
Green.
No. Oh, that one, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Sarah,
that, you know, there you go. There are microclimates, and you just don't want to hedge your bets. You just
that's what I
know what works.
So farmers live high-risk lives, right?
It's so exciting, you don't even know.
Yeah.
Come be a farmer.
You'll love it. It's thrilling.
Adventure.
Yeah. Sarah, I'm going to say thank you. Is there anything you want to leave us with? We've got a couple callers I'd like to try to get to before the hour is over. But, you know, one last word of wisdom from a three-decade farmer in the Valley.
Yeah, I guess I would say that we, the thing that would certainly, what people need to do is make a commitment or realize that local eating local foods isn't just something to do on a lark, but it's actually something that the whole entire culture and community has to make a commitment to, from government, you know, down to citizens, et cetera. And I feel that we, as a, you know, an American culture up here, have not yet really done that. So
okay.
Yeah. I think it takes a whole lot of support and structure or support from the government down, and there's more to be done in that regard.
Rachel wants to add something.
I do. I fully support that statement. I did some work for several years in West Africa on food security and launching a food business, and we did some market surveys in the beginning about people's preference for local. Like, does local matter here? Like, in Italy, local just is. Mm-hmm. It's not a label.
Exactly.
People just eat it.
They demand it.
Yeah, and it's like the tomatoes down the street are just better because they're fresher. Mm-hmm. And so as I was doing this work in West Africa and we were polling about this preference for local, people were just like, what are you asking? Like, of course our tomatoes are from here. You know, it was just, and the infrastructure there was wildly underdeveloped. We had a lot of commodity imports, so mm-hmm. grain and rice, but really, and we're talking because some of the roads were washed out for half the year, you know, your tomatoes are coming from 10 miles away.
And that was too far.
Because people are walking it. They didn't have, you know, vehicles were,
I see.
Were rare as well.
So local means something different wherever you are.
We would call it hyper-local here.
Hyper-local.
That's a growing trend.
All right.
But I agree with the caller, yeah.
Well, Sarah, thank you. I'm going to let you go back. I really appreciate you taking the time out to talk with us.
All right, you bet. I'll get back to my zucchini.
Take care, Sarah.
All right.
And I'd like to welcome Jerry onto Hometown Alaska. Hi, Jerry.
Or not.
Poor Jerry. We made him. Oh, hi, Jerry. You're there.
Yep.
Hi.
Yes, I'm here.
You're on Hometown Alaska. What's your question?
Okay, I have an alert for people on organics and bees, and that is that we need to get a hold of the Department of Agriculture because there's some elements in the Department of Agriculture that are pretty anti-organic and anti-bee because we have available to Alaska a very non-toxic method to address spruce beetles, which affects agriculture, by the way, because of it killing bees. We have a chemical up here that's called 7SL that's being sprayed in massive quantities to address spruce beetles that kills bees. And the Department of Agriculture is prohibiting the method that's used mostly all over the lower 48 in Canada and around the world in northern latitudes that's totally non-toxic. They're prohibiting that from being shipped to Alaska and the soil bank. There's a under-the-table, non-publicized soil bank legislation. I don't know if it's been through or not, but
okay.
It's something that people need to investigate.
Yeah. Jerry, thank you. We only have a couple minutes left, so I'm going to, if you'll leave us with your number, I will check out with the Division of Ag. I'll follow up on your questions with them. So I'm going to say thank you. We just have a couple minutes left, but I'm glad you called in and shared that with us. And I'm going to try one more caller before we're out. I'd like to welcome Stu onto Hometown Alaska. Hi, Stu.
Thank you very much.
And Stu, we have about 20 seconds.
I understand. Public Affairs Officer for Jay Bear has come to the Northeast Community Council, and he says it's an assembly's decision on where any boundaries may be changed. And there's obviously potential for agriculture in North Muldoon if we adjust some of the boundaries around here. And we have a very high density population where people might actually be able to work it.
So if people wanted to follow up on that, they would talk to Jay Bear Public Affairs?
Just get involved with your community council, the Muldoon Council.
Muldoon Community Council. Okay. Wow. Thank you, Jerry. Or Stu, thank you so much for that. Obviously, we are out of time. You hear the music? We have got to go. I want to thank our guests today, Margaret Atsit, Christy Short, Sarah Bean, Johanna Heron, and Rachel Miller. I'll be back as your host next Monday on Hometown Alaska when we talk with folks at Covenant House about the issue of teen homelessness in our community. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Eric Bork is our audio engineer. I'm Kathleen McCoy. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.